Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Martin Willis, your host, and I'm still out on the West Coast. I'm in California. I'm in my old... Unbelievable. I hit the wrong button. I'm in my old stomping grounds, where I used to live for, somewhere around 8 or 9 years. And I'm in Tiburon, California, which is in the San Francisco Bay Area, a beautiful place, exploring old places I used to go and having a wonderful time and meeting up with some old friends. Tomorrow, meeting with my good friend Dean Alioto, who eventually he'll be on the show talking about a great docuseries that he has coming out. I've seen enough of it to tell you it's going to be fantastic. So meeting with Dean tomorrow, heading back east, and then in November 5th, heading out to Phoenix, Arizona, to go to the MUFON boot camp, investigator boot camp. And I'm going to be filming. We're going to be doing a show from there as well. So podcast UFO on the road. That's what I am doing. So the blog this week is called A UFO Photographed in the Italian Alps. And that is back in 1952. And I do believe the bottom line, it's a very interesting hoaxed image. Check out that blog by Charles Lear. Great material as always. My guest this evening, Alfred Quiros. And I think I have talked about this a number of times, but if you're new or just started listening to the show, I had an insurance broker many years ago. I want to say it was about mid 1990s. And we were discussing, we were done doing our business for an insurance policy. And he was walking around the house. We were just discussing different things. And he said, I had an interesting, I forget what he said, an interesting position in the military during the Vietnam War. And so I said, well, what did you do exactly? And he said, I was on part of a team on the Air Force investigating UFOs during the war. And, at that time, of course, I didn't have the show, and I knew a little bit about maybe one or two UFO sightings, but I didn't really know too much about UFOs in general. Not that I know anything now, but anyway, so I asked him more and more about it, and it was a fascinating conversation, and I had the question that everyone seems to have, and that is, what are they doing? What are they doing here? If you think they're really here. The question I did ask him is, what does the government think they are? And his answer was, we are a petri dish. And I thought that was a fascinating answer. And I thought about it for a long time, years later. And when I started doing the show, I tried to look him up. I remember his name was Tom Bowden, and he was in New Hampshire, I believe. And I've tried to find him because I'd love to have him back on the show. And I've never been able to find out anything on the internet, whatever happened to him. But our guest this evening is going to be talking about encounters during the Vietnam War. And I'm really excited to talk to him about it. It's the first time that he is in a public venue speaking about this. And thanks to kind of the ridicule factor kind of dissipating in the UFO topic, he was willing to speak about it. And he's a professor emeritus of art. And here he is. Alfred, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Glad to be on here, Martin. Thank you.
Yes. And, I want to say thank you to the person that connected us. And right now, it's escaping my mind.
Robert Fresconi.
Who was it?
Robert Fresconi. He was the field investigator who was investigating a photograph I had taken in April of this year.
Oh, well, we're definitely going to be talking about that, too. So thank you, Robert, so much for connecting us together. And so let's hear. Now, when we were talking off air, you mentioned that it was you didn't even like to admit that you were involved in the Vietnam War because of the stigma. You all came back from Vietnam and, you were in the San Francisco, where I am right now, basically in the San Francisco Bay Area, and you had to keep it very quiet.
Well, it was a period of time where there was a large anti-war protest going on during the Vietnam War. I got out of the service in 1967, and went right into art school and San Francisco Art Institute to study painting. And you didn't bring it up. If you wanted to date young ladies, you did not mention the fact that you were a veteran. So for a while there, I used to have a lie and just tell people, the people would ask, because I was a little bit older than the rest of the freshmen. And they would ask me, where were you? What did you do before school? And so I would tell them that I was studying at the University of Southern Nevada, US of N.
Hmm.
And if they were from the West Coast and they knew universities, then I would say I was in Southern Nebraska. I was studying oceanography. That was the joke I had.
Yeah.
So I didn't mention it very, very often that I was a veteran. I probably about 1985, I finally came out and asserted the fact that I was a Vietnam veteran.
Yeah, yeah. And so I don't know if you want to jump right into, but well, I guess before we jump right into the topic, I mean, into your encounters, I want to ask you, did you ever pay attention to the UFO topic prior to the first encounter?
Well, the only thing I remember seeing, it was in the movie theater. We saw a movie about the UFO, the P-51 pilot that crashed, chasing a UFO. And it was just one of those newsreel things that we saw in the movies. That was about it. That's all I knew about UFOs. In that sense, I was about maybe in the fifth, sixth grade. So I didn't pay too much attention to it. You know, and that was a period of time when there was all these flying saucer movies, creatures from outer space, and all that stuff was going on. So we all thought it was all part of the Hollywood thing, you know.
Yeah, yeah. So do you want to, now you had, was it two, we're going to be talking about your encounter that you had.
Two incidents that I partook in. Let's put it that way.
Okay.
The first incident happened, we were en route, we had just left Midway Island when we were en route to Guam. And I was on watch. This was probably around the middle of January. I figured it was probably around the 24th of January, 1966. I was a quartermaster third class, QM3. And the quartermaster on a ship steers the ship into the harbor, out of the harbor, alongside other ships, etc. And we're also the assistant navigator. So we navigate the ship. And that's our job when we're on watch, is to make sure that the ship is on course. And also we keep the ship's log, and we're also the ship's weatherman. So on this night, I'm on the mid-watch, midnight to 4. The bridge crew consists of two lookouts, a radio man, the officer of the deck, which is a senior officer, the junior officer of the deck, which is a junior officer, the bosun's mate of the watch, the messenger of the watch, the steersman or the helmsman, and the annunciator guy, the guy that runs the engines forward and back, and then myself, the quartermaster of the watch. And my job was to maintain the ship stays on course, and I'm taking fixes about every 45 minutes, every hour. We have to have a fix, and we go from there. So I had taken a break, and usually at this point in time, the sky was incredibly clear. You get what is called the dome effect in the middle of the ocean. In other words, you have horizon to horizon stars.
Yeah.
So I would get my 7x50 binoculars that I always had around my neck, and I would just aim them straight up, 90 degrees straight up, and just look and just like realize how infinitely small we were in regard to the space that we were looking at. And as I was looking at, and with my binoculars, I was looking at the stars, and all of a sudden I noticed there was a V formation, five little white dots moving very slowly. So almost like a satellite. So I immediately chewed out the lookouts that were above me, they're standing on top of the bridge. So I chewed them out because I was a quartermaster's third class, corporal in the Army. And I chewed them out. I said, why did you report those lights? And they go, what lights? I said, those up there, those right up there. Oh my God, yeah. I said, you're supposed to report those right away. So I informed the officer that we got a flight of aircraft, heading from Guam, same way we are, because we were in a northwesterly direction at the time. So we just, went through regular rigmarole, where, in other words, standard operating procedure. We call CIC, Combat Information Center, and say, hey, what do you guys got on radar? And he said, well, we don't have nothing on radar. I said, well, I said, we're looking at five objects, and they seem to be moving along pretty high up. They're in a V formation, headed the same direction we are. So well, that's why we assumed there was maybe a flight of B-52s. And then we were wondering why they had their landing lights on or something. But anyway, so at that point, the radar man say, well, why don't you contact Guam? We'll contact Guam, see what they've got coming in. So they contacted Guam Air Force Base, and Guam reported back right away, saying, we don't have anybody coming in. We don't know what they're looking at. So they suggested they contact Tachikawa Air Force Base in Japan. So the radar men contact Tachikawa Air Force Base, and they say, well, okay, we got these five things moving along, and nobody seems to know what they are. And Tachikawa Air Force Base responded with a negative, saying, we got nothing in the air. We don't know what you guys are looking at. So they recommended the third radar site, which was in Hong Kong. And they said, British have the strongest radar in this area. Why don't you contact them, see what they've got coming in? Okay, so we contact the British. Nothing. We said, we don't know what you guys are looking at. We were getting the same response all the time. So, but this time, we're all looking at these guys. We're all there with our binoculars. Now, we kept thinking that only they kept going straight and just kept going, we would have just forgotten about it and logged it as five aircraft, and that would have been the end. But these were moving along, and then all of a sudden, they made a 90-degree turn. I mean, literally, wham, bam, an L, and then just took off. I mean, they just vanished. I mean, and I was yelling, dead reckoning, dead reckoning. So I was looking towards the direction they went, and they were gone. So at that point, we all kind of lowered our binoculars slowly and just kind of looked at each other. And I just looked at the operations officer who was up, the officer of the OOD, the officer of the deck, senior officer, he was a full lieutenant. And I said to him, how do I log that in? What was that, Mach 20, Mach 30, what speed was that? That was a 90-degree turn with no hesitation. They just boom, boom, did an L. I mean, there was no arcing of a turn. An aircraft would arc. These guys, boom, boom, 90 degrees, a shift, change in direction, and then just took off. They just vaporized. They were gone. So I just looked at the officer of the deck, and I said, how do I log that in? I said, and he said, gentlemen, I believe you call those UFOs. So that point, I said, do I have permission to log it as such? And he said, log it in as you saw it, quartermaster. And I said, I will log it in as I saw it. These were five objects making a 90-degree turn and then going at a fantastically high speed. And the other thing the officer said at that point was, gentlemen, let us hope whoever they are on our side.
Yeah.
So that was it. So I logged it in. The funny part about this situation is I was the guy that when a ship's log was filled, I was the guy that had a key to the ship's log locker, which was located in the forecastle of the destroyer that I was on. We would always put the logs in there and mark them the date when these filled out and everything else. So I went into, after I put the log away, after the log was filled, I put them away. I went back into the ship's log because I wanted to take that page out. In other words, I wanted a souvenir because I knew whatever we had witnessed was something very spectacular and something very, very unusual. And it's something that it was starting to alter my consciousness about what I was doing and what we were doing, things like that. So when I went to go pilfer the page of that log, the log was gone. Someone beat me to it. Wow. So, and I wasn't about to go asking questions. You know, hey, who took that log? So I figure it had to be an officer or someone else that had the key. I was the only enlisted man that had a key to that locker, and I believe the executive officer and the navigator, which was an officer, had the key to that locker. So somebody.
Are you saying the whole log journal was gone? The whole book?
The whole book.
Wow. And when something like that happens, isn't that really like something major? I mean,
Well, we kept quiet about it. And the reason we kept quiet, we were afraid of ridicule. And we didn't want to have anybody ridiculing us. And, you know, the term, did you see any little green men, too, that kind of would come up. I believe I told one other assistant navigator about it, and he just laughed.
Yeah.
So I figured, okay, we got to zip it. But I mean, there was, there were two lookouts, the boatswain's mate of the watch, the two officers, the messenger of the watch, and myself and a radio man were the witnesses to this.
Yeah. And so when this thing, you're kind of unsure how far it is in elevation, how high it is in elevation.
We figured these were at satellite height, we figured. And we knew about satellites because we were aware of the Echo satellite.
Go ahead. Well, my question is,
use the Echo satellite as a ruse for officers that were learning how to use a sextant. In other words, we knew the Echo satellite was going to be over our head.
But let me ask you this: Would a radar go to that height, to that level, to elevation?
That I don't know. That you'd have to ask a radar thing. We had a 300-mile range, long-range radar. I believe it was 300 miles.
Wow. So
that tells you anything.
Here's a question that came in a chat. When the light shot off, was the point of the V pointed in the direction of the movement? And that's a very good question.
Pointed in the direction of the what?
Of the V, the forward V, like aerodynamically.
Yeah, the point of the V, they literally just went boom, boom, and the V always stayed the V.
To the front.
Shifted, just literally shifted like that.
Yeah, yeah.
And then just, gone. I have to tell you a funny thing that did happen in 1977. I went to go see the movie Star Wars. I was living in Providence, Rhode Island. We went to see the movie Star Wars for the first time when it came out. And there's a scene where Han Solo puts his spaceship into hyperdrive hyperspace. Well, when he did that, I reacted. And I out loud, and people in the audience in the movie theater were telling me to shut up. Because I freaked. I just like, oh my God, that's what those UFOs did in 1966. They're giving them to hyperspace. And everybody was like, shh, sit down. And I was just so excited because that was what it looked like to me. Like these UFOs, when they made that 90 return, they just didn't turn and keep going. They turned and took and gone, and they were gone. I mean, boom, vanished.
Yeah.
This is what freaked us all out because we just, like I said, we all just kind of lowered our binoculars really slowly and just looked at each other like, okay, did you just see what I just saw? kind of thing, you know?
Yeah. And so your other encounter was at close range. Do I have that right?
Yes, correct. And that was a little bit different encounter. By this time, we were off the coast of Vietnam. We were maybe 2, 3 miles, 4 miles, 5 miles off the coast of Vietnam. We were conducting shore bombardment off of the Quang Tri, I believe is the area we were operating in, just below the DMZ line, the 17th parallel. So we were moving back and forth, awaiting orders from an aircraft. There was a spotter plane flying over the area, the ground area, over the South Vietnam area, Quang Tri area. We were waiting for shore bombardment targets. And as we were cruising along, I was on the bridge. I don't know why. I don't remember if I wasn't on watch. So I was probably conducting my normal duties on the bridge, going around. And we were maybe in a condition 3 battle station. So I wasn't at a battle station. In other words, we weren't at full battle stations. When all of a sudden, bright day, it was sunny, hot, humid. This is like about April 1966. When all of a sudden the lookouts start yelling, there's a ball in the water. There's something in the water, a ball in the water, silver ball in the water. And this was about maybe 100 yards, 75 yards in front of us. So So the ship slows down. The ship is slowed down, and the captain is called to the bridge. So the captain comes to the bridge, and he says, "What's going on?" He says, "There's the lookout's report. There's a silver ball in the water ahead of us." So the captain says, orders immediately, turn the ship off. So all the systems go off. The ship's engine's turned off. Everything's turned off. Pretty soon it gets really eerie because it's really silent. And then the captain tells these two officers, get into the safe. And the safe was under the chart desk. So I had a chart desk where in the pilot house where we work on the chart, where we did our fixes. And so we had the chart on the chart desk. So they open the safe and they bring out this huge book, this huge notebook. And I mean, it says Warsaw Pact weapons. And then it says top secret across it. And they said, Kiros, and we all went by our last name. So they said, Kiros, look away. You only have a secret clearance. This is a top secret thing. So I had to turn my head away and not look at the book, but you know, I could look at it. And they were looking through mines, the mine area. So they're looking to see what kind of mine it is. Because we thought, at that point, we thought it was a mine. Because it was just bobbing below the surface. We're just bobbing. So at that point, the captain says, we're not going to get near. Back the ship up slightly. So we back the ship up. By this time, you know, the residual, you know, when we turn the ship up, we're still moving. So by this time, the captain says, yeah, we got to back the ship up. Because we were getting closer to this object. So the captain said, we don't want to deal with this nonsense. We don't want to deal with this thing. We don't know what it is. So we called a helicopter. We had an aircraft carrier in the area. I forget which aircraft. We were operating with maybe three aircraft carriers at the time. One of the main ones we were operating with was the Enterprise.
Well, speaking of names, here's a question here. What was the name of that ship again? The one you were on?
I was on the USS Wedderburn, DD-684.
Wedderburn. Okay. Thank you. Oh, there it is right there. Wedderburn. I got it.
Yep. Wedderburn.
Yep.
It's a Fletcher-class, 2100 Fletcher-class destroyer. We still had our five gun mounts.
Nice you had that book handy like that. Wow.
Yeah, that's the yearbook I worked on for the cruise. It's a cruise book. So consequently, the helicopter comes in. By this time, we've got the helicopter pilot's on our radio. So he's talking. We can hear him. So I started filming. I had an 8mm camera, a regular 8mm camera. So I started filming a little bit, getting it going. And the captain turns and sees me with the camera. And he says, put that thing away, Kiros. And I go, yes, sir. I put the camera away. So I got no footage of anything because I just barely started when he saw me. And so the helicopter comes. Goes in front of us and lowers a cable or some kind of a device down, a long cable, and it's some kind of sonar device. And he's describing it to us. He's, you know, over the radio, we're listening on the bridge. We're listening to the broadcast on the bridge, and he's saying it's a smooth ball, silver, 6 feet diameter, no seams, no markings, no rivets. It's totally smooth. So he says, it doesn't seem to be doing anything. So I said, I'm looking at the chart, trying to figure, you know, and we were off the coast. So there's a lot of shoals and the ground is kind of strange. In fact, we had to use some old French charts that showed sandy shoals and things like that. So we're concerned about not running aground a little bit. At this point, the helicopter is lowering this thing, and he's not getting anything out of the cable he lowers. He raises the cable up, and he says, we're going to try something. So we're like, what's he going to do? Also, we realize he kind of puts the helicopter to one side a little bit, and the side gunner opens fire. So by this time, we're seeing tracers flying off of this thing. So we're ducking down on the bulwark of the ship of the bridge. We're like, whoa, this guy doesn't realize these tracers are flying all over the place. And then all of a sudden, the helicopter pilot starts yelling, it took off, it took off, it took off. And the helicopter goes into a spin and flies kind of like in its direction of where it took off. So the captain immediately orders, turn the ship back on, sound general quarters. This is not a drill. We're going to general quarters, set the ASW anti-submarine warfare team in action. So there's the bong, bong, bong. We're going to general quarters. We start chasing this thing. We don't even know what it is. So we think it's maybe some kind of transponder. At this point, they're discussing some kind of transponder device from a submarine. So we had our sonar going. We're looking for a submarine of some kind. We searched for 72 hours, which is standard operating procedure. Nothing. Zero. Nothing. No submarines. No nothing. There was nothing in the area. It was clear water. So we don't know what the heck it was and what it was doing there and how it took off and who pulled it. Because it sounded like somebody had pulled it underwater. So that's why we thought it was a submarine, because it went down when it... So, and I never saw it. We never really saw it because it was, you know, under the surface of the water. The lookouts just saw the shimmer of this thing. Now, we knew what mines looked like because we had encountered a World War II mine and had one of our sharpshooters exploded.
Now, when this thing took off, was there sonar in use or anything like that?
We turned everything on. At that point, when that thing took off, our sonar was our sonar operators were everything was on back on. I mean, it was like instantaneously, everything went back on. We started the ship up, everything.
Yep.
And off we went. And the only question I had was the fact that the water, we were in a kind of a shallow area. And I mentioned to one of the officers, I don't know if a submarine can operate in this water. This is kind of shallow area. We're off the coast. We're not really in deep, deep water. So that was the only question I had. And to this day, I have no idea what it was. And I almost forgot about it a little bit. And I even brought it up with a former shipmate of mine and asked him, do you remember the silver ball incident? And he says, no, I don't. He says, yes. Because it was something that, you know, we didn't see anything. So we figured it's a sight unseen.
Wow. Well, that's something else. I wish there could have been some data showing, you know, the speed that this thing had. Hang on just one second.
Sure.
I wish there was some data where they could have seen the speed of this thing traveling underwater, you know.
Yeah, we don't know. The helicopter pilot was the one that saw it, took off.
He saw it take off. Now, did you see
75 yards ahead of us?
So were you actually watching at the time?
Yes, I was.
And did you see any wake in the water, any movement in the water?
Nothing.
And the reason I'm bringing that up, and I think it's your answer is interesting, because other accounts of what they call USOs, unidentified submerged object or submersible, whatever it is that there's transmedium movement without causing disturbance, which is very, very strange. Like, for instance, when these things are seen to go in or out of the water, there's no splash. Oh. And they're also seen, and I'm not saying this is what you saw. I don't know what you saw, but
we don't know what we saw either.
When they travel underwater at high speeds, it almost doesn't even make any sense. How they can do that in and out of the different mediums.
It's just like I never forgot the words of the helicopter pilot, because, you know, it just, he sounded scared. I mean, he sounded like he was, you know, yelling, it took off. And it was like, wow. And he was turning, his helicopter was, you know, going into a, like a spin. And we're like, well, what does he mean it took off? We didn't see anything take off. So,
yeah.
So it almost sounded like something, like somebody had pulled it on from underwater, or it went on its own. We don't know. I honestly have to say, I really don't know whether it was pulled or it went on its own. But whatever it was, it went underwater and it took off.
Can you explain again what exactly who fired on this thing? Someone fired on it.
The helicopter fired
on it.
Yeah.
And
we couldn't believe it. We just, you know, all of a sudden he just opened up. The door gunner just all of a sudden just started shooting. And like I said, there was tracers are flying off in the air, and it was like, and all of a sudden we like freaked out a little bit. But I remember ducking down behind the bulwark, and I'm like, "What is this guy doing?"
Well, it's a wonder. It's a wonder they would do that. You're only 75 yards or so away, and if this thing blew up, I mean, it seems like it could have caused some damage to the helicopter as well. I mean, it's kind of a strange reaction, and I wonder.
This was we were off the coast of Vietnam, so
Yeah. I guess you had to take all the precautions, and so he was basically, it sounds like he was, if he thought it was a mine, he was trying to blow it up.
Yeah.
You know, so
the other thing is when they were looking through the Warsaw Pact book, there was nothing of that description in the book.
And they let you know that? They let you know that much?
The officers explained to the captain, there's nothing in the book. There's no smooth silver ball in the book.
Yeah.
Well, the Warsaw Pact nations do not have a silver ball, smooth silver ball with no seams or no spikes or anything, just a smooth silver ball, 6 foot diameter. There was no such thing unless it was a new secret weapon. We don't know. We're speculating now.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there's so much speculation when it comes to this. It wouldn't be surprising if you told me the thing rose up out of the water either. You know, I mean, that would have been quite spectacular. And so you searched for 72 hours in the direction.
That's standard operating procedure is a 72 hour search. Yeah. So for 3 days, we chased nothing. And radar had nothing, and we kept going in circles, literally zigzagging and doing all kinds of maneuvers, thinking where this thing might have gone, and nothing. We turned up nothing.
And what was this speculation?
Submarine transponder device.
And with something?
Submarine, belonged to a submarine.
I see, and it pulled it back down?
Yeah, that's what they thought. I mean, because nobody was going to, that was, we were talking, normal military kind of thinking. Okay, you got a ball that's floating in the water. Oh, whose ball is it? Well, it has to belong to somebody. It must belong to another ship or something.
Yeah.
We just didn't know what ship.
Yeah, yeah.
So it was one of those mysteries, you're left scratching your head and you go like, okay, what's next?
Yeah, yeah.
And that's about it. And we, to this day, we don't know what we saw. And then now with what's happening today with these spheres that are going into the water, I'm starting to wonder, was that one of those things or what? I don't know.
Right, right. I had a friend, he's been on the show many times, Mark D'Antonio, and he was on an excursion on a submarine as a guest because of some work that he did that was related to it. Uh-huh. And they had something moving that they called a fast mover. That was they already had a term for it. It was going over 200 knots and underwater. And you figure this is, I think it was, he said it was in the 90s or maybe early 2000s. You know, we didn't have any technology that would do that speed.
No.
And, you think of
the fastest ship at that time in 1966 was the USS Enterprise.
Yeah.
Carrier.
Yeah.
Whenever they would launch their planes. And there was areas in the Tonkin Gulf where there was no wind. So the aircraft carrier had to create wind.
Oh, wow.
At one time, we chased that carrier. He signaled back to us, Mike speed, 60 plus knots. And we're going 25, almost 30 knots, and we were popping rivets. Literally, I was on a World War II destroyer. We're moving through the water at 30 knots. Our ship was rumbling. We were in a rumble. And by the time we caught up to the aircraft carrier, they had already launched their aircraft and were coming back.
Yeah.
I mean, they were going plus 60 knots on the water, on the surface.
Well, it takes remember reading an article one time about boating, like power boating. So for every knot it takes so much more power. And the higher you go up, like if you want your motorboat to go 80 knots, it takes an enormous amount of power.
Yeah.
Once you get over like 40 knots to make it go higher. So if you can picture something that is submerged traveling at over 200 knots, I mean, it just seems like it would take, an enormous amount of pressure around, to make something like that happen. A question that Richard has here, the tracer bullets were actually ricocheting off the object. Is that what they were shot with tracer bullets?
Well, every other, I think, I forget how it's loaded. I didn't know how it was loaded. I mean, we saw tracers. And there wasn't like a steady stream of tracers. This was like maybe every five or six rounds or something. In other words, every once in a while you'd see a tracer shoot off. That's what scared us. We started to see the tracers. Because, normally I know we carried 50 caliber machine guns on our ship. I think there was maybe every six round was a tracer or something like that. I forget the military term of it, because I never had to fire the machine guns. That wasn't my job.
Yeah. So these things happened to you, and what was it like, behind the scenes? Like, for instance, let's go back to the first encounter, and was like in the mess hall or whatever. Was there talk, what do you think?
We didn't bring it up.
Yeah.
Nobody that was on the watch brought it up. Because I think we were afraid of ridicule.
Yeah.
One of the things that you had to be aware of when you're on a small ship, you got a crew of 250 men aboard this destroyer. And like I said, it's a Fletcher class, 2100 class destroyer. And there was a lot of harassment all the time. I mean, if somebody got a Dear John letter, everybody on the ship knew it, and that poor guy had it for about a month until somebody else, you could harass somebody else. I mean, there was always that kind. It was almost a rite of passage kind of a thing, if you must say. So,
yeah.
I mean, I remember, for example, for myself, I wrote a letter to my girlfriend, and then I threw it away and put it in the garbage can. My mistake was throwing it in the garbage can, because then it was pulled out by other crewmen, and they all had a section of the letter that was read out loud in front of all the crewmen.
So you can imagine. That's awful.
That's the kind of thing I'm talking about. That's the kind of thing I'm talking about.
That is so terrible.
So my reaction to when they were reading my letter, I responded by saying, "Where'd you find the letter?" "In the garbage." "Yeah, that's where you guys were, in the garbage, huh?" Because you had to learn how to throw it back, or else.
Once
they got a weakness in you, boy.
Yep.
That was your torment for the rest of your cruise.
This question is, I don't know if you even know it. Are these M14 Tracer or 50 caliber?
I have no idea what they're shooting.
Yeah. Well, all right, going back to the first encounter.
I don't think it was a 50 caliber. I do not think it was 50 caliber.
Okay.
Because a 50 caliber machine gun is a pretty heavy machine gun. It's about 85 pounds. And the reason I know that is that one of my jobs, when we went to general quarters, we had a 50 caliber machine gun that was strapped to the side of our chart house. In other words, where we worked on charts, our chart room. And my job when we went to general quarters was to take that 50 caliber machine gun that was strapped to the wall, throw it over my shoulder, go up the ladder to the bridge, hand it to the gunner's mates who were on top of the bridge, and they had a machine gun mount on top of the bridge.
Wow. Those things are probably pretty heavy, too, to move lug around like that.
85 pounds.
85 pounds. Amazing.
Without bullets.
Yeah. Yeah. So when you're looking at this, let's talk about the first encounter. It's amazing that you just happened to be looking up.
It was the way I relaxed. Once I did a fix and showed the officer of the deck where we were in the position of the ship, how we were doing, did we need to change course, how was our drift, and all these kind of things that you do when you're navigating. What kind of drift do you have? Do we have a following sea? Are we going against the sea? Are we doing good time? Or are we going to arrive when we're supposed to arrive? Because our job was to rendezvous with some other destroyers before we pulled into Guam, so we could pull in as in a column. So that was, and we were kind of operating by ourselves. So in points of relaxing, I would just get my binoculars and look straight up, and just, I really enjoyed that. It was a lot of fun just looking up and seeing all the stars. Just an incredible view. And if anybody's ever seen that, you'll understand what I'm talking about when you get what is called the dome effect.
Yeah.
Being under a dome.
Yeah, yeah.
So well, anything moving, boy, you spot it.
Yeah. I was doing other shows, and I actually had the pleasure of meeting and doing a interview with a gentleman that was at the time, I think someone else has beat the record. It's not a record you want to beat, and that is to be how long he was by himself in a life raft, trying to survive until he was found. And I forget how many days it was. It was all many, many, many days. And so after I did the interview, of course, it had nothing to do with UFOs. It was completely about his survival, which was an amazing story all on its own. There was a book written about it, Adrift, it was called. But anyway, so I said, hey, by the way, I do a show on UFOs too. And I said, you were out at sea in the dark every night, and you could see all the stars and everything. Did you ever see anything weird? And he goes, yes. And so I go, can you talk about, I try to get more information. He's, maybe another time I'll talk about it, that type of thing. But so, you're out there, you have the vast sky, and, if something is going to happen, it's kind of like you think about commercial pilots, they have, when they're up in the sky, they have, if it's clear, you can see a big range, hundreds of miles in all directions, So, there's no way to tell exactly how high this thing is. The radar thing is a little murky to me because I'm not sure. Did you say that they can see within 300 miles? Is that what you said?
Surface radar. It's a surface radar.
Surface radar.
Yeah.
Okay.
The radars on the ship are for, they had one, we have two radar devices on the mast. A small one on the very top, and then a large search radar right below that one. And I don't know what their full function. I know that the bottom one had a range of 300, but it was a surface radar. In other words, they couldn't aim it up.
Oh, now the other.
This is why it was suggested to contact Guam Air Force Base to see who they had coming in.
Yeah,
we thought it was a flight of B-52s.
Yeah,
I mean, but that was our initial reaction. And I mean, we were real casual about it. There's five aircraft up there, and must be, and we were casual, very quiet, this must be a flight of B-52s. And then you, hey, CIC, what do you got? And then it changed, all of a sudden the focus started changing. All of a sudden when Guam said to check with Tachikawa Air Force Base, something's going on here. And, like I said, we went through three radar sites or three radar stations, and they said, we don't know what you're looking at.
So the three, I'm just going to hang in here just a little bit on the radar. So the different radar stations, what I'm trying to get at is if there was an object up at possibly satellite height, because satellites can go way, way high, but possibly at, say, lower satellite height in elevation, are there radars that could capture something like that? That's what I was trying to get at. Do you know?
I you're asking the wrong guy. I really don't know. We were just following procedure. This is the standard operating procedure. You call one person, they say, no, you check with this person. Okay, we'll check with that person.
Yeah.
Okay, person says, check with that person. Okay, we'll check with that person. That's what we were doing. We were just checking off what we were going through the procedures. We're thinking like a U.S. military ship. We're not taking it very casual. At first we were taking it casually because it just looked like an aircraft flying along. But when the last radar said, we don't know what you're looking at. That's when we all were looking at them. That's when we all had our binoculars looking at them. And that's when, and the sensation, I don't know, maybe maybe it's just my own feeling, but the sensation was they picked up that we were looking at them or something. And they decided to change course all of a sudden.
Yeah.
I've never seen anything maneuver like that in my life.
Right.
To this day, I've never seen anybody that could be moving along and then make a 90-degree turn without hesitation and just, boom, gone. And I mean, they were gone like that.
Would you say that they were gone like in a streak, or were they gone like vanish?
Both, streak and vanish.
Yeah.
They just zoomed out. I mean, the minute they made that turn, they took off. I mean, they just zap. And that's when I started yelling, dead reckoning, assuming that they would appear at a certain direction. Dead reckoning means you're trying to follow their direction. I was yelling, dead reckoning. And we all kind of aimed our binoculars where we thought they might be next. But they were gone. They were totally, totally gone.
Yeah. So did this thing fly in the same structure V? Like, you never saw that change? Like, what I'm trying to ask you, it looked like possibly like a triangular shape possibly a V shape.
They were a V like this.
Yeah.
So it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 lights in a V.
Yeah.
1 point and 2 on the side.
Yeah. Now here's something someone called in one time and posed a very good question, and that, why would they have lights? You know, I'm not asking you that question, but I'm just saying that is a very good question. If whatever it is traveled, whatever it is to get here and is like way up there, why would they bother to have lights? They don't need lights, but obviously these things seem to have lights most of the time.
They were five dots lit up.
Yeah, it's almost like whatever it is not afraid that someone is seeing it, and it's almost like, here I am. You can see
it. Yeah, it was
And I think one of the...
This is what it...
Like that. Yeah. Well, I can tell you're an artist. I can tell you are an artist if you can draw that quickly and that evenly.
Well, it was embedded in my mind. I mean, it really, after that incident, I have to admit to you, I was very pro Navy, pro government, pro everything when I was in the Navy. I mean, we were on our way to our, this was why I was on my second tour. We were on our second cruise to the Vietnamese area. So we were very, how should I say, positive about what we were doing. I mean, we felt very positive. We did have one conscientious objector on the ship, and he jumped off the ship in a serious situation.
He jumped off the ship?
Yeah.
Like he was gone forever?
No, we picked him up.
Oh my God. Wow.
Well, I'll tell you the situation. We were assisting Vietnamese Marines landing. Vietnamese Marines were conducting a landing on this beach area, and we were to provide gunfire support for them. And so we're waiting for I'm on the bridge at the time, but that was my battle station at that point. We switched our battle stations. The navigators were always switching their battle stations. Sometimes we'd be on the bridge, we'd be in after steering, we'd be in the secondary con. We were always moving around and just to give ourselves a little bit of variety. So this time I was on the bridge, and we were conducting this, these Vietnamese Marines landed with little boats and stuff, and we were going to go gunfire support. While we're waiting for the orders to open fire, we kept hearing somebody yelling, "I am a conscientious objector. I am against the war of Vietnam." We're looking around. Who the hell is that? Who the hell's yelling? Finally, somebody said, "Look up on the mast." We looked up at the mast, and there's this guy at the very top of the mast. And we're going slow, because we're on gunfire support, so the ship is yawing back and forth. So the mast is going like this. So I'm thinking, if that guy jumps the wrong time, he's going to hit the deck.
Right.
But if he you know, he's going to have to wait till the ship yaws over the ocean. Then he's going to have to do his jump. And that's a long jump, too.
That's a very high jump.
I thought, this, you know, I hope he jumps in deep water, hits deep water, because there's a lot of shoals. We were in an area, and these shoals are marked with bamboo sticks sticking out. The fishermen, the Vietnamese fishermen, have these bamboo sticks sticking out of the water. So we have to maneuver away from them. And so he jumped, and we had to call off what we were doing to rescue him, because now we had a man overboard.
Right.
So we rescued him, brought him aboard the ship. People were really angry with him. It was some intended violence towards him, because we were in a combat situation, and here's this guy jumping off. And we've been waiting for this combat situation for so long, and finally here we are getting into action, and this guy disrupts it by jumping off the ship. So the captain brought him up to the bridge. He's soaking wet. The captain looks at him. He says, "You're lucky that the Congress has not declared war. Because if anything, this was desertion under fire. We would have just shot him."
Jeez. Wow.
Desertion under fire.
Wow. Going back here's the a question. Has your guest had a sighting since? We will talk about that later after the break. We're going into the break here in just a couple of minutes, and it's a 5-minute break. Now did I hear you say that you knew someone else that also had an encounter during the war?
Yeah, one of the navigators told me that he actually came down and woke me up. He was on watch, and he said they were looking at the ground because we'd watch the action at night. We could watch the action at night. You know, tracers going back and forth. Watch the war. And he said that there was an amber light that went back and forth, was going back and forth, an amber light, and then that the amber light shot straight up and took off, disappeared. Wow. So it's an amber light. So I said, well, there's only, according to the U.S. Navy, there's only two kinds of vehicles that would have amber lights. One is a submarine, and the other one is a hovercraft. Hovercraft don't shoot straight up. So he said it was the weirdest thing, man. It was weird. It kept going back and forth, really fast. And then it all just went, choo, straight up. And I was like, are you waking me up for that?
So this happened on the same ship or another ship that you were on?
Same ship. Yeah. Same time.
Yeah. Did you start to question, what the heck is going on here? I mean,
We did. And, you know, I had a roommate who was first air cav, and he told me about a time they were out in the field, because I told him the story about the UFO thing. And then he said, you know, and the funny thing is, we had provided gunfire support for this first air cav. In fact, we had provided shotgun support. In other words, they were driving along what is Highway 1 in Vietnam, and we were going along the water providing gunfire support, protecting them. And he remembered the number on my ship and wrote to me. He says, "Is your ship number 684? And I wrote back to him, "Yeah, that's my ship. So you guys were providing gunfire, providing a shotgun for us. You were riding shotgun for us." And I'm like, wow, it's incident. So here he was talking. We were talking. This is after we got out of the service. He was my roommate when I was going to art school. And we were talking, and he said, "You know, a weird thing happened to us." And I said, "What was that?" He said, "We were out in the field, and it was at night. And all of a sudden, this big black thing went over us real slow." And he said, "And the pressure," he said, "all of a sudden, all of us just lay down."
Oh, my God.
"And it just went over us, and then it just passed."
I can't believe you're saying this, because
it was a dark black thing. He said it went over us.
Yeah.
He said we literally had to lay down.
Yes. This is really fascinating, because I have a guest from Australia that is going to be talking, you know, briefly on my show about something very similar. She told me the story about, she told me the story about 9 years ago that her and her grandmother were in their garden, and this black triangle floated very slowly over them and made the pressure like they had to go lay down on the ground.
Wow, I've never heard of that.
Yeah, yeah,
amazing. You got to realize this is all the same year, 66.
Wow. Well, we have to go. It's time for us to go into commercial break. Okay. And it's a treat for those of you on YouTube and also on Facebook watching, because we have a five-minute clip about a UFO sighting that happened outside of Detroit, and it's pretty interesting. So for those of you over at KGRA Radio, we'll be right back right after this five-minute break. All right, so I'm with Mark Richard, and he had a sighting outside of a building you're in right now. You're working right now?
Yes, I'm actually, I live and work in the building. I'm the head of maintenance for the apartment building. So sighting actually happened back in 2008. I don't have the exact date, but I think it was somewhere late October, early November of 2008.
And can you explain exactly, something caught your eye out the window?
Yes, I was working at the time. I think it was maybe around 2 p.m. or so, and it was a bright, sunny day, not a cloud in the sky. Something kept reflecting light into my eye. Every time I would look up from my work, this something out the window is reflecting this light into my eye. After about the third or fourth time of this happening, I'm getting a little annoyed, and I walked over to the window. This is an old historic building. We have huge windows. Walked over to the window, and I'm looking at this thing. I can see it. I'm in downtown Detroit. I've been here for several years, so I'm used to seeing traffic copters. I thought it was a traffic copter. It looked like it was over the expressway out there, maybe like a mile and a half, 2 miles out. It was out there a little ways. So I lay eyes on this thing, and pretty much as soon as I do, it starts moving towards kind of my general direction. And I'm still thinking at the time, this is a helicopter. It's annoying. With the clip that this thing moved towards me, I'm starting to second guess now, is this a helicopter or not? Because this thing was covering this mile and a half, 2 miles very quickly. Within seconds, it was outside of my building and slowly coming towards me to the point where this craft, I'm now in full view of a craft that is hovering outside of my, I'm on the 13th story of an 18-story building. This thing's hovering outside of my window. It starts to rotate up so that it's now sort of 90 degrees to me, where I'm looking directly at the bottom of this craft. It's got three large white lights on the bottom and a smaller red light in the center that's kind of pulsing. And this thing starts to rotate clockwise, and the three white lights start flashing a pattern. And it's rotating, and the pattern's going a little bit faster and a little bit faster. And then the outside edges of these white lights start to flash in colors. So now I'm getting every color of the rainbow. It reminded me of one of those Simon games from back in the 80s where you try to hit the colors. It was
right,
something like that. As it's rotating and it's speeding up, to by the time this thing was at full bore, it was just a blur of light, like the most vivid, bright, colorful light. And at that point, I kind of felt like I was being sort of mesmerized or being kind of drawn in mentally by this thing. And it made me pause, and it made me sort of put almost a mental block right there where I said, hold on, what's going on here? This is obviously very strange. I've never seen anything like this before. And when I did that, when I kind of put a mental stop to it and kind of put the brakes on things mentally, the flashing lights stopped. The craft slowly rotated back down to an upright position, and it just kind of floated off to my right-hand side and kind of floated around the building to where I couldn't see it anymore. I was expecting to see this thing shoot off into space or something. It never did. It just kind of floated off slowly. I tried to keep my eye on it for as long as I could. And once I lost sight of it, I actually ran down to the street level to try to get outside and get my eyes back on it. But I had lost it at that point, and it was gone.
Wow. Well, we're already up to 4 minutes.
Oh my gosh.
So that's okay. Well, that's all right. We'll be running a little bit longer of a commercial that day. We'll run it 4 minutes and 30 seconds. Bill always likes it over at KGRA when I can run longer, but we're out of time now. Mark, thank you so much. That's a really interesting sighting. Very
great.
All right, welcome back. Bill probably really liked that when I said that they like the long breaks over at KGRA Radio for the commercials. But anyway, back with my guest, Alfred. Thank you, Alfred, again for talking about this. I always enjoy people that have never talked about this before, and it's something new and fresh, something very interesting. Actually, the last encounter you told me about this black thing and then the pressure and those people like push him to the ground. I think that's so fascinating because you're going back to 1966 and the woman that'll be on the show, I think we're going back to the late 1970s when she was young. Mm-hmm. And so these things, you know, people can say all they want about, you know, secret military craft, black projects, things like that. But could they possibly have had that technology starting in 1966, that would never be used by us in any type of situation? You know, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I don't know. It just makes me wonder. I mean, I have read quite a bit about the German technology and World War II and what they were working on. And of course, you know, there's speculation that the Germans were developing a UFO, and I've read some accounts where they actually flew a craft I believe it was in Prague, Czechoslovakia. They flew a craft and it went up to 2,000 miles per hour. But it's all speculation. We really don't know if that really happened because they destroyed all the records of that craft because they didn't want the Russians to get a hold of it or something like that. And then there's some people that believe the UFOs that were sighted in 1946, the first UFOs where the term flying saucer was used, by that pilot in Washington, I believe.
47, right. Yeah.
Yeah, and they think that there is some connection with British intelligence that was working in that area of British Columbia. I don't know. There's a lot of things I've read, and I've always read these things with a grain of salt. I kind of like, okay, do you have the... And even when I look at a photograph, I wonder about it. I have to show you what started this thing with MUFON and I was back in April of this year. I'm an artist and I saw a cloud that had this incredible yellowish tinge to it. And I said, wow, that is a really wild yellow and it's so pale. I wonder if I can catch it with a camera. So I went and grabbed my camera and I shot a picture of it. Can I show you the picture?
Oh, yes. Matter of fact, you can send the picture to me, and I will put it in the show notes permanently.
Okay, I'll do that.
Go ahead and hold that up right now.
Okay, here's the picture I took of the cloud.
Yep.
I didn't notice anything until I downloaded the camera and saw this little black speck. I don't know if you can see it.
I can see it, yep. You got to hold it up more, but yeah.
And I saw that little black speck, and I go, what the heck is that? I said, I didn't see that. I didn't see it. When I took the photograph, I didn't see it. The photograph was shot at 5/6 of a second, and the speed was 1/500th of a second. I took two photographs, this one, and then a shot of zoom back and took another shot. By the second shot, the object is gone. So here's a close-up of it.
I can't see it. It's got to come up. Got to come up. There you go.
There.
Okay.
There's a close-up of it.
So when the investigator came, the person that connected us two together, did he rule out? I know this sounds really bizarre, but did he rule out either an insect or bird?
No, in fact, they called it they called it a blurfo, B-L-U-R-F-O, blurfo. I said, I have never heard of that term blurfo. And they sent me a long explanation of what a blurfo was. It could be a bird, an insect. and I looked at the photograph and I said, that's got to be a really large insect because that thing was further away than the cloud. It almost seemed to be in the same distance as the cloud. And both Robert Frasconi and I both noticed that there was a kind of a little trail, a very, very, very slight trail behind this object. And I said, I don't know what I photographed. I didn't see it. I never saw the object. This thing was in 1/500th of a second. So, you know, it was beyond my eye speed. So that's what started this whole thing. And so once we started, I met over the phone with Mr. Frascone. We started talking about it, and then he asked me if I had any other experiences, and then I told him about my Navy experiences. And then he told me about you, and that's how we are now.
Yeah. I think one of the most interesting aspects of your first encounter is that the ship's log was missing after that.
Yeah. I thought that was very, very strange that somebody would take the ship's log.
Yeah. I mean, had that ever happened prior, or had you ever noticed that happening at any other time?
No, ever, never.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, and we would, you know, and the ship's logs were big. You know, they're like about 8.5 by 14, you know, paper bound and all that stuff. And on the front, you have a start date when you start the log and et cetera, et cetera. And you record everything in the ship's log. You know, Joe Blow cut his finger. The corpsman applied a Band-Aid. He's okay. Yeah. He went back to work. That kind of thing goes in the ship's log. So every little thing that goes on in the ship is recorded. So,
yeah, of course. And that's
diary, in other words.
It's been that way for centuries.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, so it is really odd how that whole thing disappeared. And you never saw it. Now, let me ask you this. So what do? Get a new log and you start again? You know?
Well, yeah. Once you finish a log, you put the end date on it, or the last date on it, you sign it. You say, okay, this has been signed by whoever finished the last log. And then you put the date and they say, okay, give it to Quiroz to put it in the log locker. So then we start a new log. You start a new log, first date.
Yep.
So we had a stack of, you know, new logs ready to go. So we never run out.
Right. And what about the documentation of the second encounter?
That was probably put in the ship's log also. I was not in charge of the ship's log at that time. Somebody else was in charge of writing that up.
Yeah.
So whoever was the quartermaster at that time, there was four of us. There was a first-class petty officer, a second-class petty officer, two seamen, and myself, a third-class petty officer. And so it was either, it had to be one of the petty officers that was writing the log. So it was either the second-class petty officer, the first-class petty officer, or myself. And I was, at that time, I was not writing the ship's log.
Now I'm just going to just change the conversation a little bit. So when you saw this, I'm asking about your personal experience. You saw this object. It seemed to appear to be at a very high elevation, but then it all of a sudden it did things you can't explain. Right. And you were among many witnesses that saw this, all saw it happen at the same time. Right. What was your aftermath thoughts about what you saw? Like, did you think, wow, you know, maybe we are being visited, or, you know, did you think about it?
I did. I thought a lot about it. It really, like I said, it altered my consciousness and made me start to think. I started to think of who the heck was he? Who are they? What are they doing? And why are they doing that? Right? And, and were they showing off? I mean, that was our first reaction. Were these guys showing off? Look what we can do. I mean, I don't know, because, you know, I kept thinking, if they had kept going straight, if only they had kept going straight, we would have forgotten all about it. We would have thought, yeah, so somebody's aircraft, they just kept going, you know, unusual aircraft, whatever.
Yeah.
And we would have forgotten about it. But that maneuver, that 90-degree turn, and then just taking off like that, the way they did, that's what was indelible in my mind. And that kind of like, what the hell was that?
Yeah.
Because we all, like I said, we all just looked at each other like, did you just see what I just saw? Or am I dreaming? And, you know, it was kind of like, holy mackerel, it was startling. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
It's very unusual. I mean, we were used to seeing jets. We were used to seeing other ships.
Yeah.
So, you know, something that outdoes us kind of made you feel like,
yeah,
you're not alone.
Right.
Whoever that is, this was the operations officer. Okay, this is a full lieutenant. In other words, in the Army, he would be a captain, and this was a straight kind of arrow kind of guy. This is the kind of guy most officers on the ship. You saluted him in the morning, and that was it. You were done saluting for the rest of the day.
Mm-hmm.
This officer, you had to salute every time you saw him. He was he was an Annapolis guy.
Yeah,
very serious.
Yeah.
Very serious. His demeanor changed after that. He was not as serious anymore. He started to smile a little more.
Huh.
I can tell you his name. I can even show you a picture of the officer, but I don't think I should, because I don't have permission from that gentleman to be showing this photograph.
Right, right. So this question, this is another speculation. Could the V craft have been one solid craft? Most likely, if it turned in an instant, right, and the 90-degree angle, then the V formation never changed, right?
Right, never.
Yeah.
They were like this, and they went like that.
Right.
Boom. And I mean, not that slow.
Yeah.
They were boom, boom. They were gone. I mean. It was almost like an elongation slightly. Like when they took off, it was like a
streak,
like a blur. Yeah, like a blur. And they were gone. Then all the lights were gone.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's really a good one. How far offshore were you at that point?
No, we were in the middle of the ocean. We were traveling from Midway Island to Guam. We were in a part of the ocean where the charts are white because there's no land. So we had. In fact, we were marking rocks. We were working with sonar at the time, marking rocks. In other words, we're navigating and actually creating things for the charts, you know, things that are there. You know, oh, there's a rock was sighted here in 1953, such, such. You know, things like that would be on the chart. And so we were documenting new things through a so we could send it to the Notice to Mariners. The Notice to Mariners is the international document that goes out to all ships at sea. Say a buoy's been moved 50 yards this way. Okay, so they send out a Notice to Mariners. Buoy so-and-so has been moved this way or that way. It's always indicating any kind of change in navigational markers or anything like that. So that was our job, was always keep our charts up to date. So we were always looking at Notice to Mariners and correcting our charts all the time. We were correcting charts. That was our daily job, correcting charts, making sure we were up to date.
Right. Bill, that the KGRA radio producer, sent me a question for you. Wanted to know what you thought about the military coming for, not just pilots, but people like himself who observed things on naval vessels.
Well, it's about time. I think there's probably a lot more out there. And what I'm hoping with this podcast is that some of the witnesses that were on the destroyer, when I was on the destroyer, who saw the V formation, will start to acknowledge. I mean, you know, there was quite a few witnesses, you know. There was definitely two officers, a full lieutenant and a ensign. One of the junior officers of the deck. So I know they all saw the same thing I saw.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping maybe one of them will remember it. or remember the ball. I did ask one of the other navigators if they remember the ball incident, and he couldn't remember it.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering, you know, how, you know, if that's like selective thinking or you know, I don't know. I really don't know. I really thought that, you know, people would remember us turning the ship off, because that is one of the eeriest feeling to have when you're middle of the water and all of a sudden there's nothing. You have no engine. You're used to the ship sounds all the time. You know, the engines are going.
Right.
You're used to a certain hum in the ship. And all of a sudden there's a hum and all you hear is the water lapping on the side of the water, on the side of the ship. You kind of like really feel eerie.
Yeah. Yeah.
So all of a sudden you're not under power.
You know, I've heard of people that have had, you know, actual UFO encounters, and the people that they witnessed with said they don't remember, which is pretty bizarre, you know.
It makes me wonder if they were in shock to the point that they just pushed that out of their mind. They don't want to remember it, because it is kind of a scary thing. I mean, you know, we were kind of I was a little freaked out about it when you say, you know, you just saw something, they make a 90-degree turn and disappears. That's unusual. I have seen other things like that where I'll be looking. I tell people I'm a junior astronomer. I became a junior astronomer. I have a couple of telescopes already. My binoculars, I have my standard 7x50 binoculars that I still use. And I have so often will be looking at the sky and I'll see something like a star and I'll go, wow, what star is that? I don't remember that star being there. And all of a sudden it'll just go out. It'll be like stationary light and then all of a sudden it just goes out. And I go, okay, that's not a satellite. I know what satellites look like. Satellites keep moving in one direction. They don't maneuver. Satellites do not maneuver. They don't change properly. They keep in a steady, they're in orbit.
No, I've had a few people tell me that they've seen satellites and then all of a sudden they'll move jag off in one direction. So sometimes there's an atmospheric issues that can make, you know, the lights change colors and blink and things like that.
Curvature of the Earth too, as a satellite, you know, goes to the other side of the Earth kind of thing. They'll go out, you know.
That's all sun reflected. Yeah. The sun, even though we don't see the sun, it's on, the reflection is still up, from the sun up there. And space junk too. Now, I've never seen any space junk, but I've heard people talk about it. One friend told me a story about being on the CE5, whatever it is, has to do with Stephen Greer's famous groups that he gets together and to see UFOs. And the person believed they were actually seeing space junk. All the UFOs were just space junk, which also supposedly reflects from the sun until it gets out of range of the sunbeam. But
if it's space junk, then it usually will be going in one direction. It won't be unless it's falling. You know, falling space junk.
Yeah. And like I said, I've seen a lot of satellites, but I've never seen. What's that?
Space junk doesn't maneuver.
Not that we know of. Not. It's not supposed to. Let's see. Someone was asking, have you ever had any other types of experiences? Whoops, you there? Uh-oh, looks like Alfred has frozen. I'm not really sure what happened. Let me take them out, bring them back in. All right, so I think we lost our guest here for a moment. I'm going to try to see if he'll come back in, but right now I have to remove him. And Bill, I'm wondering if you can hear me here, if you can come on the show for a couple minutes and let me see if I can. Let's see. I don't know how to do that. So hopefully he'll be coming back in. He's gone. Bill, are you able to talk a little bit, chat a little bit? Oh, okay. All right.
I find him fascinating. And just from my perspective, I believe him to be 100% authentic, Martin.
Yeah. I don't see why he wouldn't be. You're right.
I mean, the you can body language says a lot about a person, not just their vocal, you know, speaking.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
You can tell, I mean, he's very passionate about what he's discussing. And then when he went back, and you kind of changed the perspective of the question, kind of, he still reiterated the same thing he said earlier.
Yeah.
You know, interesting, really interesting cases he was talking about.
Right.
And I wish that people would come forward. It's too bad that those people that were on the ship with him, I don't know if they're still alive, you know, if they're still in service. Maybe that's a reason why they're not coming forward. Because they're still active duty. I don't know. They would be rather quite up there in age, but this is the Vietnam War era.
Right.
But
right.
I think it's important that people like himself come forward. So maybe that would encourage others to come forward as well.
That's right. That's right. Bill, I'm hearing feedback coming through your speakers when coming back through your mic. I just had to mute you when I'm talking. So I think your speakers are a little bit loud there or something. So I'm just going to, are you using a headset? I don't know why I'm hearing the feedback. Anyway, we're hoping that Alfred comes back on. It appeared that his internet did go out. And there's a question here. Martin, did your sighting change direction? Yes, it did. What happened, the UFO sighting I had, Bill, I'm going to have to mute you. I don't know why, but the UFO sighting that I had in Carmel Valley, just drove through there the other day, was just a craft that went over in one direction and stopped and just stayed, you know, for me at this point, trying to remember exactly how long it stayed stationary. I'm going to say 5 seconds, maybe. And then it went off in a very straight angle toward Monterey from the direction I was in. So, yeah, I mean, it changed directions, but it was going very slow the whole time. And I can't judge the height of it, so I can't figure out exactly how far it was. Anyway.
Now, do I still have that echo? Because I kind of changed some settings on my background.
Yeah. No, we're all set now. Thank you.
Okay. Now, what I saw over my house, and I apologize to folks that are watching. I've had oral surgery, so it's a little tough for me to have a conversation right now. That's why Martin mentioned that before he brought me on. But when I captured that over my house, it curved down, curved back up, curved a little to the right, stopped, whew, gone.
I think that was swamp gas. Should be.
Yeah. But I mean, I will never say it's extraterrestrial or interdimensional because it's unclear. It was way up there. There's no way to discern what the object was. And it could be a drone because you mentioned something. Remember he mentioned about satellites being stationary?
Yeah.
Or going in an orbit?
Yeah.
Geosynchronous, whatever. Right now, we know that under development by the world powers, let's just say, with the controlled hypersonic missiles that are going on, where they can actually control the trajectory of this projectile or whatever the platform they're using. I would not be surprised there's drones that they're using in space. Also, satellites can move. There are killer satellites out there, Martin, that they can actually connect and throw off other satellites. You can look it up. They're called killer satellites. They can move toward another satellite to take it out. So just because we think that maybe, you know, a satellite goes in an orbit, trust me, you know they're doing all kinds of stuff up there that the public isn't aware of.
That very well, that's kind of scary.
It is, but I'm just saying you have to think about all the possibilities. I think a lot of people that are watching right now would say we need to deal with all the possible rational explanations before coming to a conclusion where now we've eliminated all those possibilities. Now what is it?
Right.
We don't know. And that's the things that need to be investigated. But with all the stuff that all these countries are testing right now, I mean, I'm just a person that believes a lot of the stuff that we see is natural phenomenon, man-made phenomenon.
Right.
And man-made in top secret experimental level craft. That's just my opinion.
Yeah.
But I'm sure there's a small percentage that fits under that category of unexplainable.
That's right. Well, while we're at this juncture, I'm just going to say, too, I'm not getting an email or any correspondence from our guests. I'm not sure if he's coming back on, if he's just, you know, his internet's gone. Who knows? I had a situation where someone was on years ago, and I think their house got struck by lightning or something.
Wow.
And they were gone. That was definitely a government plan, I'm sure.
You know. Well, I'll tell you one thing. He is a fascinating guest. I agree with Pamela in chat. And I told you privately in chat, I find this discussion fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah. I've always liked, and by the way, you know, I have some recordings already of people that had a UFO encounter. I like to run these during the breaks. If you'd like to email me and tell me about your UFO encounter, if I think we can do a clip about it, I will do that. And my email address is martin@podcastufo.com. So also, I got to say, the guests that I was supposed to have for this coming next week, I have not heard back from. So if you are curious what our guest is going to be each week, then all you have to do is go to podcastufo.com, go over to the sidebar, and subscribe to our weekly newsletter. And then each week you'll get a link to the blog and a link to the guest information. So I'm not sure, Bill, if our guest is coming back or not.
Well, if you would like to call in, I can jump off and take your calls. If you have calls for Martin, hopefully.
Yeah, we can try.
His guest will come back. And if his guest comes back, you can ask questions.
Whoops. Sorry about that, Bill.
That's all right.
I'm just hearing some echoing again. All right. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to put up, here's the phone number for anyone would like to call in. That number is 855-472-5483. If you want to call in now and talk about basically anything, the direction that the UFO topic seems to be headed in. Some people want to talk about disclosure. I have mixed feelings about that actual word. I'm not really sure.
Wait, now that you say that, wasn't tonight the night that they had something at the National Press Club?
Yes, that's correct. Bob Salas, who was on the show a while back. It is tonight. I was trying to find out more information about that just before we went on the air. And it's supposed to be, he's back in, where's the National Press Club? Washington, D.C.?
Yes, I actually may have a link to the live YouTube stream.
Oh,
Peter Robbins. Yeah, I'm going to send it to you this way. I'll put it in the private chat. But Peter Robbins is the only person there that is technically in the field of ufology.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
But he sent me a link, and I'll try to pull it up while we're on the air, and then you could share it to that stream.
So yeah, that sounds like a good idea.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people would find that fascinating exactly. To watch.
Yeah.
So I'll look it up. I think I may have it. Here it is. So I'm going to click on the link myself so I can grab it. And I'm going to mute so we don't hear it on the air.
Oh, my God. Someone says they think I'm on the wacky weed. Isn't that funny? Well, you know, maybe that would help. I might try that next time. But thank you for that, Larry.
All right. There is the link.
All right.
It was this morning, actually, Martin.
Okay.
But you can go there and watch it, folks.
All right. I will. Let's see. How can I do that?
You want
that?
Me to send it to you on Skype? This way you can.
No, that's fine. I have I have an idea what to do, but I.
Okay. But it was from 8:30 to 11 this morning, so it's 2.5 hours. And we do.
Well,
yeah, we do have a caller, so you can take me off. So.
I do have a caller.
Yes. So get me off so I can answer the phone.
All right,
have a great night, everybody.
All right. But I got to bring you back in when the caller.
Yeah, I'll take myself off camera.
All right. All right. So Bill is taking a call. We have a caller into the show. Thank you for our patience. I can only guess that somehow Our guest tonight lost his internet. That's unfortunate. It was a great conversation. I'll keep my eyes open to see if he comes back. And hopefully he will come back. But right now we have someone Bill is taking, screening the call right now. And if you'd like to call in, that number again, right up on the screen, 855-472-5483. Was it Harry or Larry that said he thought I was on the wacky weed? But anyway, hopefully it was Larry. And we have Harry from Louisiana. Welcome to the show. You're live.
Call in. That number again, right up. 472.
All right. All right. This is what's going to have to happen, Harry. You're going to have to mute your show. You're watching the show live, obviously. So, Harry, mute the show, please. Mute the show. And, Bill, hopefully you can remember to tell people to do that. We got a couple calls. But right now we have Harry, you there?
Yeah, I am, yes.
Hi. Welcome to the show. You have a question or you want to talk about a topic?
I was interested in the triangle UFOs that forced the witnesses to the ground. I hadn't heard that before, and I'm interested in knowing more about that.
Yeah. Well, I would now, Katie in Australia is a person I know. Now, it was a triangle for her. I couldn't get the fact that when he said this black object, this was during the Vietnam War back in 1966, when it flew over the people on the ground, it forced them to the ground. And that's something he didn't really say, you know, hopefully he'll come back on, but he didn't really say the shape of that craft. However, Katie, who will be on the show at some point, is going to go into detail about what she saw over them. So, yeah, that is a fascinating story.
Great. It is interesting. I just went out online a few minutes ago and was just looking at triangle UFO stories, trying to see something, anything I could find about that. I just thought that was an interesting kind of phenomenon associated with that. I'm just, you know, just it makes you speculate about what could be, what you know, what kind of propulsion system or whatever could be producing that effect, but that's really fascinating.
It almost seems like an anti-gravity or something like that.
Well, yeah, that's kind of what I thought, but I don't know that effect in other reports. I mean, I may have heard it and just forgot, but it doesn't seem to be too common, and there have been a lot of UFO reports over the many decades. That would be interesting to like do a search of sightings or close-up encounters that where people were physically affected and maybe forced even to the ground by it. That's
that's only the second time that I've ever heard that, and so yeah, I think that is fascinating. And I'm just hearing from my guests now, just to let everyone know, I did hear back, it's Dr. Irina Scott. She's going to be on next week, on next week's show. So have you ever, Harry, have you ever looked into Dave Marler's great book on triangle UFOs?
I haven't looked I haven't seen the book. I was, I think, aware that there was a book. In fact, just now out online, I noticed some mention of that, I think. So yeah, maybe I need to check that out and see.
It's wonderful research. Now, I talk to Dave quite often, but that's something I've never remembered to ask him about the pressure effect. If any of these triangle UFOs, I have his book. I mean, I suppose I could. I have a lot of books to read through, but that's one of them that, you know, from the part that I did read, I've read part of it. It's so well written and documented and great stuff. You don't hear a lot of triangle UFOs early on, but there are some. There are some encounters that go back, but just there's just very few of them. It seems like it's the vehicle of choice these days. I mean, it seems like there's a lot more triangles than others. But we're stacked up. We actually have two more people waiting in line. Anything else, Harry?
Okay. Well, just very quickly, for a long time I've been wanting to see a panel convened to discuss whether or not the government might have actually acquired technology over the decades that would allow them to have anti-gravity craft. All the money that goes into black projects, they must have explored that. And I'd love to see a panel of like physicists and aerospace people just speculate. There's nothing that I know of in the private sector that indicates that that humanity has that ability right now, not in the private sector. I would just wonder if experts could speculate about whether the government might have focused enough money to have actually produced that kind of thing, because that would be technology that would maybe explain a lot of these things away as ours and not from somewhere else.
I can understand, though, if they are trying to keep it secret, because it would be such a it would be such a step ahead of everyone else if we actually had something like that. And also you can think of all the uses we could have if we actually had that type of thing available to us. The energy that, well, I don't know what type of energy it would take to create the innate gravity. If it's not a lot of energy, perhaps travel could be completely revolutionary, in the future. So, but anyway, we've got four people now online waiting to talk.
Thank you. I enjoyed talking to you.
All right. All right, Harry, take care. Thank you. All right. Next, we have William from Florida. William, you're live on the air.
Hi, Martin. Good evening.
Good evening. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. I had the opportunity to install a security system, cameras and DVR at my house. And next door, I put a few cameras on the roof and aimed them straight up. what I use wide spectrum cameras that could see more than just visible light. They could be infrared and ultraviolet.
Can I just ask you something?
Sure.
Are you on speakerphone?
No, I'm not. Let me check.
Okay.
Bad connection?
It was fading in and out, so I wonder if you just make sure you can speak into the mouthpiece and continue on, if you would.
Okay. Let me go to a different part of the house. In a brick house, so it's reception's a little spotty.
Yeah.
Okay. So you hear me now?
Yeah, but it is fading in and out, so go ahead, though.
Okay. So what I noticed was the DVR has a recording log, and it puts a watermark on a 24-hour type of display so you can see whatever motion sensed by any of the cameras. And what I was noticing occasionally, and this would happen maybe once a week or so, but every Sunday I'd sit down, sip my coffee, and look at what, what went through the yard or went over the house. And many times it was helicopters and planes. And so I was seeing these balls of light going across the sky occasionally. Some were closer, some were further up. Some I saw in a V pattern, like you were talking about earlier with the guy from the Vietnam
War. Yep.
And so very amazing. So what I ended up doing was I took a satellite dish and hacked it out. I put a high gain microphone in it instead and aimed it straight up also.
Hmm.
And when I had it hooked to the stereo, I could really crank it up. And these balls of light would never make any noise.
Mm-hmm.
Completely silent. The planes and helicopters, of course, made noise. I could even hear the jetliners that looked like a speck in the sky going over. And it was good security for the house because I could hear everything in the neighborhood as well, because it would pick up anything that was reflected around the neighborhood audioly. And so on occasions, I had some of these balls of light that were so close to the yard that you could actually see the heat trail coming off of them. And the heat is displayed at night. The image, it makes the image white on this type of wide spectrum camera. But on these ones that were close, I could actually see a heat trail behind it, almost looking like, you know, a mane of white hair, you know, with the wind blowing. And you could see this ball just slowly moving across over the house. And so my camera system, my DVR, was picking this stuff up and putting a watermark on my recorder. So what I'm basically trying to tell everybody is anybody can do this.
Yeah.
They're there all the time. It's just a matter of looking in the right spectrums. Usually they're not able to be seen with the naked eye, and that's why some people can see them and other people can't.
Oh, that's interesting. One of the things I was going to ask you, but you kind of answered the question, was that if is there an airport nearby and could these be landing lights? But you said you didn't. You can hear things from the airliners going overhead. Nothing from these. But did these things travel in the same direction every time?
No, not at all. All different directions. Some I actually saw coming straight down out of the sky. And they appeared to like enlarge as they got closer, and then they would go back up.
Really? That is
some
bizarre.
Would go across the sky horizontally, others would be vertical.
So are you saying this is not in, it's not in the visible spectrum?
Many times they're not. Now I have seen a few on occasion with my own eyes, but I don't think that all of these that were going across the sky could be seen by the general public, because I'm certain that I would have heard about it from neighbors and other people. I even had friends that would call me occasionally and say, hey, you know, there's something coming in your direction. And I was never able to catch what they saw, or if they saw something the night before, I would go back in the on the DVR, you know, and look at it from the night before, playing it back. So I tried to confirm what people saw, but never was able to catch, you know, the same direction. So my cameras were probably zoomed into about maybe 10 time magnification. So I wasn't really heavily zoomed to see something close up, but yet when you do that, then you lose your field of view. Mm-hmm. And you don't see as much. And right. So I ended up with probably two dozen occurrences that I ended up saving. And it was always, you know, great entertainment for friends that would come over, or family. We would sit there and play this stuff back. And everybody was just, you know, dumbfounded. Nobody knew what to really say.
Well, I'm wondering if you would be able to send me one of those videos, if you'd be willing to do that.
Yeah. I'd be willing to do that.
There's people I'm sure that are interested, that are listening to this right now. If I would have your permission to just put it up on YouTube with a unlisted, and then put the link to it in the show notes, so people that are listening to the show only can take a peek at it.
Right. Well, can we talk later after the call?
We'll talk later after. And what you need to do, if you would, because I have things going on this evening. It's early here in California where I am, but I need you to email me at martin@podcastufo.com. But William, thank you so much for the call. It's been fascinating. Thank you.
Thank you. And that was martin@
podcastufo.com.
Got it. Thanks, Mark.
All right. Okay, William, thank you. All right. Next, we have Stephen calling from Michigan. Stephen, welcome to the show. Stephen, are you there? Welcome to the show. All right. So let's jump over to Chris from Houston. Chris, are you there? Welcome to the show.
Hey, Martin. Hey, thanks for having me on. I've called in 3 times now, I think, and each time it's been a pleasure. So thank you for having me. I had 2 questions. I just finished watching the Skinwalker Ranch documentary by Jeremy Corbell, and with the NIDS guys out on the ranch. Oh, good. That's what I thought. I was like, I'll roll with it. Thank you.
Okay, what's going on? All right. Am I missing something here? I didn't quite catch that.
Martin, can you hear me?
I can, yes.
Okay, I think we got the names mixed up on the call, but I can go ahead with my question.
All right, what's your name?
It's Steve from Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Oh, yes, I did try you, and I guess you weren't connected at the time. Steve, welcome to the show. So anyway, we can move right along here. Tell me what it is that happened. Yeah.
Yeah, so I just finished watching the Skinwalker Ranch documentary by Jeremy Corbell, and yeah. It was interesting, you know, with the PhD scientist guys there for over 20 years, they kept talking about how the phenomenon they were trying to capture almost knew exactly where like camera positions would be. It would always pop off just like right off of the camera frame. So you could never capture it and you could never see it. And it was interesting. They always said that it did not want itself to be revealed. So, you know, I watched the New York Times come out with these videos from the feds, and I think they're amazing, but clearly they're not. It's not that golden image that can convince the world, you know, of the reality of the phenomenon. And we've never had an image like that. So I wanted you to maybe comment and speculate on, you know, if we ever will get a chance to see that, or if you just, speculating against or about like when they appear and when they allow themselves to be viewed and if we'll ever see the full extent. And last quick question, Martin, is when I go to YouTube and you're looking for UFO videos, I swear the algorithms, they give you news stories. They don't, I know there's more videos and images out there, and I'm wondering if you have any ideas or thoughts on other platforms or easier ways to access the massive amount of media that I know is out there, and I just feel that it's being suppressed. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you. You asked a number of questions there, but as far as the YouTube goes, I'm not, you know, there's some really good channels out there. I actually think that Chris Leto is doing a very good job, but he's doing it mostly on, you know, his experience and military experience. John Greenwald has a great YouTube channel, The Black Vault, and there are a number of them. We have the UFO, the Celebrity Review, Louis Yemez, a fun guy. He's got a great show. He's trying to do some really good work. So, yeah, it's hard as far as searching a word. You know, word search is very difficult because you're going to come across all kinds of, you know, bogus things and things like that. So it's tough. You got to choose your sources carefully when you're looking into this topic. So thank you. Thank you for the call. Sorry, couldn't answer it all. I'm trying to get some people in here. And next is actually a friend of the show as well, Linda Zimmerman. Linda, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you, Martin. How are you?
Great. I'm so glad you called in. How are you?
Good. You piqued my curiosity when you were mentioning the pressure from a UFO.
Yeah.
I have heard that with several witnesses, but the earliest case I've been able to find was actually Oak Park, Illinois in 1929. A fascinating case. A medical student was walking home and a 40-foot glowing disc descended to about 100-foot altitude. He felt heat, and the pressure was so strong, it literally knocked him to his knees. And when it took off, he was able to stand up, and he said the distinct odor of sulfur was in the air. So thought you might be interested in this case.
Definitely. Isn't that something that I never heard of? I don't know if I've ever heard of any encounter ever that there was like a sulfur smell. That's pretty bizarre.
Very rare.
Yeah. Yeah. And the pressure thing, I mean, we can only speculate, but it makes me wonder what was the effect on other biological things in the area, like, you know, I mean, trees, plants, dogs, you know, was it, I mean, is there any accounting of that? I mean, I'm sure when you're going all the way back to that 1929, I think that's what you said.
Right.
The details are probably not in there like that.
Not the, and plus he was walking on Euclid Street in Oak Park, which probably was more urban, I think. But yeah, there should have been trees, but he didn't say anything about that. But to me, it sounds like there's some sort of field this craft is generating. Perhaps it has to do with propulsion, or, you know, creating some sort of field in front of the craft to push someone to the ground. That has to be very strong.
I would think so. And it also makes me wonder if there was a sound issue. Like a lot of people say that sound, you know, disappears and, you know.
Initially heard humming like turbines, he said. Didn't mention any silence after that. But, you know, between the pressure, the heat, the sulfur smell, this is... this was a remarkable case.
Definitely. Linda, thank you so much for the call. It's always great to talk to you and always nice to see you when that happens. So thank you.
Yes, glad to share that. So take care.
All right, you too.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. We have just one more call. We only got a few minutes. Chris, waiting patiently in Houston, Texas. Chris, welcome to the show.
Hi, Martin. Hi, Bill.
Yeah. Thanks for being on hold all that time. Sorry about that.
No problem. I'm not calling with a personal sighting this time. I'm calling to just mention a note about the lights question that keeps coming up. Why use navigation lights on a aircraft?
Yeah.
If you're not, there's nothing, you don't want people to see you. Well, I think one thing that keeps, every time I hear this, this occurs to me, why do we use lights on our aircraft? It's not for aliens to see us. It's for other humans to see us. It's for people on the ground to see us, and specifically for other people in the air to see us. So doesn't it make perfectly good common sense that if you are a biological organism with optical visual systems that operate in what we share, which is the visible light spectrum, that if you have other craft in the area, that you would be running lights to for not for anybody on the ground, not for any of the observers or witnesses, but for your other team members who are also in the air with you or on the ground. I mean, it could be a little bit of a you know, scary thought, but it does make sense, doesn't it? That if you have aircraft spacecraft, and you operate in a visual light spectrum, then it makes sense to put lights on your aircraft, whether you're human, non-human, wherever you're from. I mean,
yeah.
And
I'm afraid though, Chris, we're out of
use lights.
We're out of time, Chris. I hate to say it, but that is it. It's quite hard, you know, and it's also hard not to think in human terms. But you did just mention, you know, maybe whoever they are needs the same thing, and that's a possibility. I don't really know, but I appreciate your thoughts on that. That was very good. Thanks a lot.
Creatures at the bottom of the ocean use lights for each other, not for us.
Good point. All right, take care.
Thanks a lot.
All right. All right, everyone. So thank you so much for hanging in with us. It's too bad we lost our guest, but I do want to thank all the callers that called in and helped us go through the show. I want to also thank Bill for helping out. And next week, we just found out we have Dr. Irina Scott. Should be a great show. Thanks so much, everyone. And remember to keep your eyes to the sky.